The African-American poet Etheridge Knight began writing in 1960 after he was sentenced 10 to 25 years at the Indiana State Prison for stealing a woman's purse. By his release in 1968, he had his first published book, fittingly titled Poems from Prison.
My reality is imprisonment. Black men die sooner. I mean, we're very much becoming an endangered species. We all operate out of our own prisons, our own private cells.
Listen to the late Etheridge Knight as he talks about his use of prison as a metaphor in a 1989 archive interview by Rebecca Presson. You'll also hear part of an earlier public poetry reading by Knight, digitized thanks to a Save America's Treasures grant from the NEA and the National Park Service. A member of the Black Arts Movement, Knight died in 1991, but his work continues to influence contemporary poets and give insight into our culture. So stay with us to hear this past American voice of new letters on the air, produced at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam. Etheridge Knight was born in Mississippi on April 19, 1931. One of seven children, he dropped out of high school and joined the Army at age 16 and served in Korea, where he was injured and became addicted to alcohol and morphine. After his discharge in 1951, he turned to crime to support his habits, which led him to jail in 1960. Poetry saved him. After his 1968 release and publication of his first book, Poems from Prison, he continued to publish. But for him, public poetry readings were his mainstay for both inspiration and money. In just a bit, we'll hear from our 1989 interview. But first, let's listen to Knight perform his poetry in front of an audience from a new Letters on the Air program recorded at the 1986 Associated Writing Programs, or AWP, conference in Chicago. He begins with a poem about one of the old men he knew in prison, who was a big storyteller, claiming he knew Al Capone and such, who watched the younger prisoners project a tough image to cover their fear. Here's Etheridge Knight.
He sees through stone. He has the secret eyes, this old black one who under prison skies sits pressed by the sun against the western wall, his pipe between purple gums. The years fall like overripe plums, bursting red flesh on the dark earth. His time is not my time, but I have known him in a time gone. He led me trembling cold into the dark forest, taught me the secret rites to make it with a woman, to be true to my brothers, to make my spear drink the blood of my enemies. Now black cats circle him, flash white teeth, snarl at the air, mashing green grass beneath shining muscles, ears peeling his words. He smiles, he knows, the hunt, the enemy. He has the secret eyes, he sees through stone. As I was telling about these young guys who are doing all this confronting, some of them were very impatient, they wanted change right away. And some of the old convicts would say, listen, fool, they have guns up there on the side. They will shoot you. sometimes we call them fascists because they could only see like this. You know. On the yard, a slim young fascist, fresh from the hole, slid into me, murdered me with his eyes, and said, man, why ain't you doing something? All night I sat up, all night, wrote 5,000 words explaining how I was doing something. But the slim cat, beautiful fascist, didn't buy it, nor did I completely. In the joint I was in, there were some guys who had been in there a long time and they'd lost contact with, they never received any mail or any visits. And there was this group of women, matrons, suburbanites, like, who would come and visit with these men. We call them do-gooders. And this particular day, a guy came to my job and said, hey, Knight, you got a visit. And I went and put on my press jeans and ran up and looked out in the visiting room, and I didn't see a black face out there. So I said, I ain't got no visit, you know. So we started bickering. And a WASP woman visits a black junkie in prison. After explanations and regulations, he walked warily in. Black hair covered his chin, subscribing to villainous ideal. This cannot be real, he thought. This is a classical mistake. This is a cake baked with embarrassing icing. Somebody's got, likely as not, a big fat tongue in cheek. What have I to do with the prim blue and proper-blooded lady? Christ indeed has risen when a junkie in prison visits with a wasp woman. Hold your stupid face, man. Learn a little grace, man. Drop a notch the sacred shield. She might have good reason, like, I was in prison and ye visited me not, or some such. So sweep clear anachronistic fear, fight the fog, and use no hot words. After the seating and the greeting, they fished for a denominator, common or uncommon, and could only summon up the fact that both were human. Be at ease, man. Try to please, man. The lady is as lost as you. You got children, ma'am, he said aloud. The thrust broke the dam, and their lines wiggled in the water. She offered no pills to cure his many ills, no compact sermons, but small and funny talk. My baby began to walk, simply cannot keep his room clean. Her chatter sparked no resurrection, and truly, no shackles were shaken. But after she had taken her leave, he walked softly, and for hours used no hot words.
Etheridge Knight, recorded for New Letters on the Air at the 1986 AWP Conference in Chicago. You're listening to this Past American Voice as part of our Save America's Treasures series. This next section comes from a 1989 interview with then New Letters on the Air host Rebecca Presson.
Upon leaving prison, Knight joined the legion of African American voices that helped define the 1960s. His early books include Poems from Prison and Belly Song. They're considered among the most powerful poetic statements of that era. In this 1989 interview, Etheridge Knight said his love for language began well before his prison experience.
According to my mother, I've been reading and writing since I was three. And I guess my first experience with poetry came about when I was a child. We used to play the dozens. It's a verbal game that young black boys play with each other where you put down the other's mother. If you can make it rhyme and hip, then, and I was pretty good at that. And
can you remember any of those? Can you say any of those?
Yeah, you know, I always make them up on the spot, like, I saw your mama the other night, and what she was doing sure ain't right. You know, it's always you putting down the other boy's parents.
And then he comes back to you.
Yeah, and you say something about my sister, and if you make it rhyme, and it goes on and on. There's a folk poems, like you've probably heard me say Shine, and Signifying Monkey. These rap songs that you hear today are direct descendants of these toasts and dozen playing. Yeah. When I was a boy, hip talk was also a lot of rhyme and rhythm. You know, see you later, alligator, when you get back, Jack. Almost in our conversation, just generally rapping. It was a lot of rhyme and rhythm in the rapping. And that's where these rap songs come from today, I believe.
So while you were doing the dozens, were you also reading any serious type poetry?
I got introduced to Paul Laurence Dunbar and Phyllis Wheatley. I went to an all-black school.
That's interesting, and your teachers did teach you black poets.
Yeah. I was fortunate in that respect because, for instance, when we have assembly, we didn't sing Star Spangled Banner. We sang Lift Every Voice and Sing Till Earth and Heavens Ring.
No kidding. And this was in Mississippi and
in Kentucky. I was born and raised until I was nine in Mississippi. And then my daddy moved north to Kentucky and found a job and worked a couple of weeks and came back and got, you know, the rest of the family. So I went from the fourth grade until I quit school in the ninth grade in Kentucky. As I say, it was a segregated school, but we got black history. I think it was valuable. And it was where I was first introduced to quote, legitimate poetry.
Etheridge Knight's academic career was short-lived. Although he was an A student, he says he found school irrelevant. Before long, he started getting into trouble with the law.
I went in the Army when I was 16 and went to Korea. The war broke out in June or September of 1950. You know, war is not really a good place for a 17-year-old boy. You know, I was trained as a medical technician, but nobody's ever really trained for all that blood and dying. And so I started using drugs. And all of the 50s, I spent in the streets. I call them my mad years. It was spent getting busted, getting out, getting hooked, getting busted, getting out, getting hooked. And then in 1960, I fell for armed robbery. And it was in the early 60s when I first defined myself as a poet. My first book was published when I was in prison. I got out in 1968.
How did you manage to get a book of poems published from prison?
I started making up poems and sending them out. And at first, you know, it was like 3 years, nothing but rejects. And finally, I had a poem accepted by the Negro Digest. It was a sister magazine to Ebony. I'd been sending poems for months to Hart Fuller, was the editor, and he told Gwendolyn Brooks about me. I suppose he said, hey, here's this guy over in the prison in Indiana, keeps sending me all these poems. She wrote to him and asked me to see some of my poems. Then Dudley Randall, who's a publisher of Broadside Press, was one of the most energetic black presses during the 60s, published my first book. Poems from prisons, mainly poems about my world. In the early 60s, the same kind of social movement that was going on the outside was going on the inside, and especially among the younger men. And in prison, young guys, if they broke the rules and keep breaking the rules, they'd first be defined as troublemakers. And if they continued to break the rules, then they'd be defined as crazy and sent to mental institutions and ugly things done to their heads. These lobotomies, I understand that they don't do them anymore, that they finally decided it was not too kosher. But they got pills. They give you
do about the same thing.
The same thing.
You said in an interview in New Letters magazine that prison was your major metaphor, even 20 years later. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Being a black male in this country, my reality is imprisonment. Black men die sooner. I mean, we're very much becoming an endangered species, you know, despite the fact Jesse Jackson running and all of that, you know, we still die sooner than anybody else. We all operate out of our own prisons, our own private cells. I see prison as my major metaphor because of the oppression, the culture, the world that keeps closing in, keeps me from being what I want to be.
How much of the way that you behave on a day-to-day basis harks back to a fear of imprisonment? I know you're kind of an elusive person. You're hard to get hold of sometimes. You try to keep sort of a low profile, I think. Does that hark back to that?
Well, not just my being in prison, just in this country. Black men who talked a lot, who were loud and seemed to exert any kind of power or influence was cut down. I mean, there's an old saying in the black community, you have to make two steps forward while you look like you're going one backwards. You know, because if it's perceived that you're going straight ahead, you would get cut down.
Maybe that's how the moonwalk was innovated.
Probably. Yeah.
The late Etheridge Knight in 1989 with Rebecca Presson.
In the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, critic Regina Hackett wrote, Etheridge Knight is the kind of poet who can sound a song on a page. Words are a pure stream for him. As New Letters on the Air continues, Knight reads another poem from his first book, Poems from Prison, and talks about his view of poetry as primarily a verbal art form.
I made up a poem young man is a friend of mine. Him and his sister had been hooked on drugs, and he used to tell me how violent this environment was that she had to move around in, hustling tricks and things. And it occurred to me that young men in prison must be the only men who experience the kind of fear that I suppose that women experience almost all the time. You know what I mean? If I'm walking down a dark street, I might be scared that somebody's gonna knock me in the head and take my money. I don't have the fear I'm gonna be sexually assaulted. And I guess young men in prison are probably the only ones who can relate to that. The violent space, or when your sister sleeps around for money. Exchange and greed, the ungraceful signs, thrust the thick notes between green apple breasts. Then the shadow of the devil descends. The violent space cries, and angel eyes, large and dark, retreat in innocence and in ice. Run, sister, run, the boogerman comes. The violent space cries silently, like you cried wide years ago in another space, speckled by the sun and the leaves of a green plum tree, and you were stung by a red wasp, and we flew home. Run, sister, run, the boogerman comes. Well, hell, little sis, wasps still sting. You are all of 17 and as alone now in your pain as you were with the sting on your brow. Well, little sis, here we are, you and I in this poem. And what should I do? Should I squat in the dust and make strange markings on the ground? Shall I chant a spell to drive the demon away? Run, sister, run, the boogerman comes. In the beginning, you were the Virgin Mary, and you are the Virgin Mary now. But somewhere between Nazareth and Bethlehem, you lost your name in the nameless void. Oh, Mary, don't you weep, don't you moan. Oh, Mary, shake your butt to the violent juke, absorb the demon puke, and watch the white eyes pop. Run, sister, run, the boogerman comes. And what do? I boil my tears in a twisted spoon and dance like an angel on the point of a needle. I sit counting syllables like Midas gold. I am not bold. I cannot yet take hold of the demon and lift his weight from your black belly. So I grab the air and sing my song, but the air cannot stand my singing long.
Most poets, you know, refer to writing their poems. You refer to making your poems up. Does that mean that the poems are written in your head more than on the page? I notice you have yet to refer to a book to recite any of these poems. What's the process when you write a poem?
To me, the act of writing is maybe 15 to 20% of the creative process. My argument is that there were poets before there were printing presses, right? Therefore, poetry is primarily an oral utterance. And in fact, to publish originally means to make a public utterance. It has nothing to do with the printed page. To me, the written word is an extension of the spoken word, not a separate entity. We live in a literate society. A poet does not really even need a pen and paper. You know, I have books published, so I have nothing against the printed word. It's just that I like to keep the horse in front of the cart.
And yet you didn't have any books in print until last year when the Pitt Poetry Series put out The Essential Etheridge Night. Was that a lapse on your part in not feeling that printing was that important? Or how come all those years went by and nobody could buy an Etheridge Night book?
I'm more into reading than writing, and poems are meant for the ears. Like now, I very seldom send poems out to be published like I used to in the earlier years. Because, in fact, when you say a poem to a group of people, you are, in fact, publishing that poem. And I think I would much rather for 100 people to hear my poems than 100 people to read.
How many readings do you give then? Do you spend a lot of time on the road?
Yeah, 30 or 40 readings a year. It's mainly how I make my living, readings and short-term workshops, visiting classes. After the joint, I steer clear of institutions of any sort.
Makes sense. Do you like to listen to other poets, too?
Yeah, I go to a lot of readings, and there are poets that I follow and get direction from and listen to and pay attention to.
Who are they? I assume Gwen Brooks is one of them.
Yeah, it's Gwendolyn Brooks, Robert Bly, Dudley Randall, Galway Connell.
You like the emotional poets.
Yeah, out of the passion is where the art comes from.
Speaking of which, you also have some wonderful love poems. Would you say a couple of those?
Rebecca Presson for New Letters on the Air, and here's the late Etheridge Knight introducing two of his well-known poems that pay tribute to women.
You know, our body of knowledge mainly comes out of the European, the Greek thought, that reason, the head, is the desired after state. And there was a suppression of the passions. To show any feelings was to be womanlike. All of the female gods, Hysteria, Demeter, were given negative connotations. In Western literature, the seat of feelings is depicted as being in the heart, you know, Cupid. We determined that the seat of feelings is in the belly. This is where it starts at, in chaos. So I titled this poem, Belly Song, for the Daytop Family. And it begins with some lines by a young poet, Sarah Mansfield, that she wrote to me once. And those lines go, "You have made something out of the sea that blew and rolled you on its salt, bitter lips. It nearly swallowed you. But I hear you are tough and harder to swallow than most." Belly Song. And I must admit that the sea in you has sung to the sea in me. And I must admit that the sea in me has fallen in love with the sea in you, because you have made something out of the sea that nearly swallowed you. And this poem I give to you. This poem is a song I sing to you from the bottom of the sea in my belly. This poem is a song about feelings, about the bone of feeling, about the stone of feeling, and the feather of feeling. This poem is a death chant and a gravestone and a prayer for the dead. For young Jackie Robinson, a moving black warrior who walked among us with a wide stride and heavy heels, moving through the blood and mud and shit of Vietnam, moving through the blood and mud and dope of America, for Jackie, who was a song and a stone and a feather of feeling, now dead and gone in this month of love. And this poem is for me. For me and the days that lay in the back of my mind when the sea rose up to swallow me and the streets I walked were lonely streets, were stone cold streets. This poem is for me and the nights when I wrapped my feelings in a sheet of ice and stared at the stars through iron bars and cried in the middle of my eyes. This poem is for me and my woman and the yesterdays when she opened to me like a flower, but I fell on her like a stone. I fell on her like a stone. And now, in my 40th year, I have come here to this house of feelings, to this singing sea, and I must admit that the sea in me has fallen in love with the sea in you, because the sea that now sings in you is the same sea that nearly swallowed you and me too. Another poem is Upon Your Leaving for Sonia. Now I want to say my last poem out of the prison, Rehabilitation and Treatment. Upon your leaving, night, and in the warm blackness, your woman smell filled the room, and our rivers flowed together, became one. My love's patterns, our sweat-drenched bellies made flat cracks as we kissed like sea waves lapping against the shore, rocks rising and rolling and sliding back. And your sighs softly calling my name became love songs, child woman songs, old as a thousand years, new as the few smiles you released like sacred doves. And I fell asleep, ashamed of my glow, of my halo, and ignoring them who waited below to take you away when the sun rose. Day and the sunlight playing in the green leaves above us fell across your face, traced the tears in your eyes and love patterns in the wet grass. And as they waited inside in triumphant patience to take you away, I begged you to stay. But Etheridge, you said, I don't know what to do. And the love pattern shifted and shimmered in your eyes. And after they had taken you and gone, the day turned stark white, bleak, blaring like the Nordic landscape. I turned and entered into the empty house and fell on the floor, laughing, trying to fill the spaces your love had left, knowing that we would not remain apart long. Our rivers had flowed together. We are one and are strong.
I love that poem.
It was written after I had gotten out of prison.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
And I was married.
The Sonia referred to in that last poem is Etheridge Knight's former wife, the poet Sonia Sanchez. Etheridge Knight published 4 books of poems in all. Only one remains in print, and that's The Essential Etheridge Knight, which was published as part of the Pitt Poetry Series at the University of Pittsburgh. Knight was interviewed at KCUR-FM in Kansas City in 1989. He died of lung cancer on March 10th at age 57.
Rebecca Prusson in 1991 with her memoriam to the poet. The book she mentioned, The Essential Etheridge Knight, is still in print. Knight was part of the Black Arts Movement, and his words continue to influence today's prominent African-American poets, from Terrence Hayes to Reginald Dwayne Betts. In fact, Betts, who served his own time in prison, credits the poetry of Knight as his rescue. You can hear a special New Letters on the Air program with him, Randall Horton, John Murillo, and Marcus Jackson called the Symphony Poets as they pay tribute to Knight. For links, go to our website, newletters.org, where you can also find decades of recordings of other important Black writers. Thanks to a Save America's Treasures grant that enabled us to digitize our archives that go back to 1977, when New Letters on the Air began. To keep up with who's next on the radio and in the podcast of our show, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, and Instagram. A production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Partial financial support comes from the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency, and listeners like you. There's a Support New Letters tab in the top right corner of newletters.org. The archive programs with Etheridge Knight were originally produced by Rebecca Prusson, Judy Ray, Carla Fish, the late John Hawken, and Chuck Haddix, now at the Marsound Archives, where our 20th century shows were digitized. Today's compilation was originally produced with Stephanie Hughes, Ross Steinmetz, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam. Thanks for listening to New Letters on the Air.